The UN Agency for Palestinian Refugees says for the first time in its history, the organization has run out of money amid the surging coronavirus pandemic in the Gaza Strip. British drug manufacturer AstraZeneca says further research is needed on its COVID-19 vaccine after questions emerged over the protection it offers. Also coming up, the European Union warns that its assessments on granting market access for British financial services will not be completed in time for January. Thank you very much for joining us. Our top story this hour, the UN Agency for Palestinian Refugees says it is facing an unprecedented financial crisis. UNRWA Commissioner General said for the first time in its history, the organization has run out of money as the coronavirus pandemic sweeps the blockaded Gaza Strip. Earlier, we discussed the issue in our news review program.
Now, the United Nations Agency for Palestinian Refugees laments it is hit by an unprecedented financial crisis.
For the first time in the history of the agency, we have no cash available anymore to cover our spending between now and the end of the year.
Felipe Lazzarini, the Commissioner General of UNRWA, said the agency has received the lowest level of contribution since 2012. Now, this is while the coronavirus pandemic is exacerbating the needs of refugees. Lazzarini tells a press conference in Gaza City that the agency is on the edge of a cliff, but it can avoid falling if the international community expresses some solidarity. The agency relies on funds from UN member states and the European Union, but its finances have been ravaged by a U.S. decision to slash hundreds of millions of dollars in aid. Lazzarini also warns that the health system in Gaza is about to collapse due to the coronavirus pandemic. Joining us now for this news review is Zafar Bangesh, Director, Institute of Contemporary Islamic Thought out of Toronto, Canada, and Mr. Bruce Katz, co-president of Palestinian and Jewish Unity, joining us out of Canada as well, Montreal to be exact. Gentlemen, I'd like to welcome you both to the program. I guess we'll start there in Toronto with you, Mr. Bangesh. Your thoughts on the possibly irreparable damage that the Trump administration has done to the plight of Palestinians over the last 4 years.
This is one of the most unfortunate developments that an agency, the United Nations Agency for Relief and Works, has been deprived of vitally needed funds that cater to the needs of today millions and millions of Palestinian refugees that are scattered all over the Middle East. When the refugee crisis first emerged back in 1948, member states of the United Nations had pledged that they would contribute funds to make sure that these refugees are looked after and their needs are looked after until such time that they are able to return to their homes in Palestine. But as you pointed out, since Donald Trump's emergence as President of the United States, he cut hundreds of millions of dollars to UNRWA, as well as other Western governments, including those in Canada, have cut funding to this United Nations agency, and it has put the Palestinian people at great risk. Also, in particular, in Gaza, which has been ravaged by the pandemic, the coronavirus pandemic, Gaza was already living a very, very precarious existence because of this very tight siege that has been imposed on Gaza from all sides, and lack of medications, unable to have clean drinking water. About 90% of the water in Gaza is contaminated. And then the fact that the healthcare system in Gaza is virtually collapsing and now made worse by the pandemic, I think we have a catastrophic situation on our hands. And unless and until donor countries step forward, I'm afraid the situation would get even worse.
Thank you, Zafar. And Bruce Katz, I'd like to welcome you to the program. Get your initial thoughts on this, Bruce. Now, how did all this money get cut from UNRWA by the Trump administration? I believe it was the fact that they didn't accept the deal of the century. I could be wrong. It could have been before that. If you remember, put this all into a perspective for us, please.
Yeah, I think that the deal of the century, at any rate, was simply a pretext. The Trump administration has been one that has used blackmail at large and called that foreign policy, especially in the vis-a-vis the question of the Palestinians. Now, we know for a fact that the elements of the Israel lobby in the United States, and I'm referring in particular to a billionaire like Sheldon Adelson, who has not only prompted Trump by way of vast amount of money donated into two campaigns, has prompted Trump not only to take an anti-Iran agenda, but also to cut aid to the Palestinians, and as well, that has also been a policy of the Netanyahu regime in Tel Aviv. Now, this is particularly odious political frumpery that has been imposed on the Palestinian people by the Trump administration, especially when you consider that UNRWA has been since 1948, quite frankly, the difference between subsistence and starvation on the part of many Palestinians, especially in the refugee camps. What basically we have witnessed with the Trump policies regarding the Palestinians and these cuts to UNRWA is essentially a crime against humanity, because under the Rome Statute that created the International Criminal Court in 2002, a crime against humanity refers to a widespread or systematic attack directed against any civilian population with the intent of causing death and suffering to that population. And again, that is with the under the statute, that is with the full knowledge of the perpetrator, and that is most certainly the case as concerns the Trump administration's cuts to UNRWA, which is now, as the gentleman from Toronto has said, resulted in a catastrophic humanitarian crisis for the Palestinians everywhere, but especially in Gaza.
Gentlemen, I want to thank you both for joining us. Pleasure to have you both on the program. Zafar Bangesh, director from the Institute of Contemporary Islamic Thought, joining us out of Toronto, Canada. And Bruce Katz, their co-president of Palestinian and Jewish Unity, joining us out of Montreal.
The British drug maker AstraZeneca plans to run an additional global trial to assess its COVID-19 vaccine effectiveness. The company's chief executive, Pascal Soriot, says studies show if efficacy of the lower dosage of the vaccine is more than the full dosage and more study is required to validate it. He noted that the international trial will be faster and needs fewer patients. AstraZeneca's COVID-19 vaccine's effectiveness is questioned, as many experts doubt the test trials were scientifically valid. Several scientists raised doubts as the company previously claimed its experimental vaccine was 90% effective in a subgroup of patients who were mistakenly given a half dose than a full dose. Experts say this could reduce the vaccine's chances of getting a quick regulatory approval from the US and the EU. The European Union has reportedly warned that a decision on whether to offer market access to UK banks and other financial institutions will not be made in time for January. An unnamed EU diplomat said the European Commission has informed member states that a so-called equivalence agreement on financial services with the UK will not be ready by January the 1st. Financial services are not part of the ongoing talks between Britain and the EU on a free trade agreement. The UK has been seeking a separate equivalence agreement with the EU in order to ensure its companies will be able to serve the bloc's customers after Brexit. Britain left the EU in January and its access to the Union's market under post-Brexit transition agreements ends on December the 31st, just over a month's time. Now, political analyst Keith Pelbaum says neither the European Union nor the UK will emerge the winner from the Brexit, but London will suffer more.
Basically, the whole thing is sort of up in the air, really. And of course, the UK is not responding quick enough to the negotiations. All right, we're at the last minute, and I think it's a warning shot from the EU saying that this is just not appropriate. This is all just to make Boris make his mind up quickly. A decision has to be made, otherwise there's just going to be chaos in Britain. And we can't afford a no deal, so there will be a deal. Have no hesitation about that. We're going to see a deal, but it's going to be a very bad deal. And of course, the EU is reminding Britain that, you know, are you really prepared to sacrifice everything for fishermen? We should have made a digital deal, Boris said, in October. We've already reaching the absolute limits. It's got to be ratified by the European Parliament, and it's got to be ratified by the politicians. So we really are at the last chance salute. But look, the EU knows that Britain will come back looking for a deal if there's even a no deal. By the end of January, we'll be looking for a deal and desperate and not in a very good negotiating position either. There's no winner. They're both losers. But the biggest loser is going to be Britain. That's quite clear. 45% of our trade goes into the EU. Less than 10% of the EU trade goes to the UK. And so it's quite clear we're both losing, but Britain's going to lose more.
Elsewhere, US President Donald Trump says he will leave the White House if the Electoral College votes for his rival Joe Biden to be the winner of the disputed election. He made the comments after a Thanksgiving Day address to US troops at the White House. This was the closest the US president has come to conceding defeat in the November 3rd election. US media declared Biden the winner of the election after projecting that he will receive 270 electoral votes required to enter the Oval Office. Trump and some of his fellow Republicans claim that the vote was rigged in favor of Biden and have filed several lawsuits to overrule the election results. The Electoral College is due to vote on December 14th to officially decide the outcome of the presidential vote. Journalist and commentator Max Parry believes the power struggle in the US is far from over, as President Donald Trump has not yet exhausted all his options to override the election results.
In addition to this statement, he also said that a lot was going to happen in between now and January 20th. So in my view, that could mean that he may be considering other legal avenues, including possibly trying to order the state legislatures, where there's a Republican majority in both houses in these contested states, to override the popular vote and elect pro-Trump electors to the Electoral College instead. I'm not so sure myself that this power struggle is over, that all of his avenues have been exhausted, and that could mean, as I said, trying to override the popular vote and get these state legislators to appoint pro-Trump electors, or taking it to the Supreme Court, which his campaign lawyer, Rudy Giuliani, seems dead set on doing.
Former Sudanese Prime Minister Sadiq al-Mehdi has died from a coronavirus infection at the age of 84. Sudan's last democratically elected leader was being treated in the United Arab Emirates. Mehdi's second term in office came to an end with the 1989 military coup that brought Omar Hassan al-Bashir to power. Following his death, the government declared 3 days of mourning. In a statement, the Lebanese resistance movement Hezbollah expressed condolences for Mehdi's death. Palestinian resistance movement Hamas also expressed sympathy, noting Mehdi's outspoken opposition to normalization of ties between Israel and Arab states. The footballing world is in mourning after the passing of Diego Maradona, a true legend of the game, but this global icon was bigger than football and leaves a lasting legacy across the globe.
World superstar Diego Armando Maradona has died after suffering a heart attack at his home in the suburbs of Buenos Aires, Argentina. At just 60 years of age, the footballing icon has shocked the world for one last time. As news broke, mourners gathered across the world to pay their respects. Tributes poured in as the sense of loss was palpable across the globe. Argentine President Alberto Fernandez declared 3 days of national mourning. In Napoli, Italy, fans gathered outside the city's San Paolo Stadium, where Maradona captained the club's most successful period. As a tribute, the club will rename their stadium in honour of him. Champions League matches throughout Europe held a minute's silence for the superstar, who is held as one of the best, if not the best, to have ever played the game. But like very few, Maradona transcended his sport. He was a global icon loved by the people. The media couldn't get enough and followed him everywhere. Much was made of his life outside of football, as the icon struggled with addiction. But for many, that was part of his appeal. He was real and not a carefully choreographed PR exercise. He was a flawed footballing genius who managed to capture the imagination of the world. Despite his stature, his personality was enormous. He famously said, "I am Maradona, who makes goals, who makes mistakes. I can take it all. I have shoulders big enough to fight with everybody." This fighting spirit shone through in the man's politics. While the mainstream media will focus on his footballing abilities, human rights campaigners across the world know they have lost a true advocate for social justice, a staunch anti-imperialist who used his platform to challenge global powers. He ardently campaigned against the Iraq War and condemned global powers destroying Syria. In 1986, when the icon scored the infamous Hand of God against England, he said it was symbolic revenge for Britain's Falklands War against his country. When it came to the Palestinian cause, he proudly wore his support. The footballing icon was a great advocate of socialist leaders in South America and was great friends with Cuban revolutionary leader Fidel Castro. He famously described him as his second father. As fate would have it, Maradona would pass away on the same day as his revolutionary friend, only 4 years apart. The shock across the world is still raw. For many, the icon passed on far too young, but Diego Armando Maradona lived his life to the fullest. He was a small man, but stood head and shoulders above all on the football pitch and inspired millions off of it. He'll be remembered as one of the greatest ever.
Brings it into our bulletin for this hour.
A diverse range of programs. youth, spirituality, culture, Eastern tales, roundtable discussions, politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
As President Trump's efforts to overturn the 2020 election have steadily disintegrated, the country appears to have escaped a doomsday scenario in the campaign's epilogue. Since 3rd of November, there have been no tanks in the streets or widespread civil unrest in the US, no brazen intervention by the judiciary or a partisan state legislature. Joseph R. Biden Jr.'s obvious victory has withstood Donald Trump's peddling of conspiracy theories and his campaign of groundless lawsuits. Even in the absence of a questionable outcome or any evidence of fraud, President Trump has managed to freeze the passage of power for most of a month. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalist Alexander Burns. The piece is titled, "Trump Stress-Tested the Election System and the Cracks Showed." Please stay with us for more of Alexander Burns' article. As President Trump's efforts to overturn the 2020 election have steadily disintegrated, the country appears to have escaped a doomsday scenario in the campaign's epilogue. Since 3rd of November, there have been no tanks on the streets or widespread civil unrest in the United States. There have been no brazen intervention by the judiciary or a partisan state legislature. Joseph Biden's obvious victory has withstood Donald Trump's peddling of conspiracy theories and his campaign of groundless lawsuits. In the end, and the post-election standoff instigated by Mr. Trump and his party is truly nearing its end, the president's attack on the election wheezed to an anticlimax. It was marked not by dangerous new political convulsions, but by a letter from an obscure Trump-appointed bureaucrat, Emily W. Murphy, of the General Services Administration, authorizing the process of formally handing over the government to Joe Biden. For now, the country appears to have avoided a ruinous breakdown of its electoral system. Next time, Americans might not be so lucky. While Donald Trump's mission to subvert the election has so far failed at every turn, it has nevertheless exposed deep cracks in the edifice of American democracy and opened the way for future disruption and perhaps future disaster. With the most amateurish of efforts, Donald Trump managed to freeze the passage of power for most of a month, commanding submissive indulgence from Republicans and stirring fear and frustration among Democrats as he explored a range of wild options for thwarting Joe Biden. He never came close to achieving his goal. Key state officials resisted his entreaties to disenfranchise huge numbers of American voters, and judges all but laughed his legal team out of court. Ben Ginsburg, the most prominent Republican election lawyer of his generation, said he doubted any future candidates would attempt to replicate Donald Trump's precise approach because it has been so unsuccessful. Few candidates and election lawyers, Mr. Ginsburg suggested, would regard Rudolph Giuliani and Sidney Powell, the public faces of Donald Trump's litigation, as the authors of an ingenious new playbook. If, in a few months, we look back and see this Trump strategy with was just an utter failure, then it's not likely to be copied, said Mr. Ginsburg, who represented former President George W. Bush in the 2000 election standoff. But the system was stress-tested as never before. That test, he said, revealed enough vague provisions and holes in American election law to make crisis all too plausible. He pointed in particular to the lack of uniform standards for the timely certification of elections by state authorities, and the uncertainty about whether state legislators had the power to appoint their own electors in defiance of the popular vote. The 2020 presidential election, he said, should be a call for some consideration of these issues. Yet even without precipitating a full-blown constitutional crisis, Donald Trump has already shattered the long-standing norm that a defeated candidate should concede quickly and gracefully and avoid contesting the results for no good reason. He and his allies also rejected the long-standing convention that the news media should declare a winner, and instead exploiting the fragmentation of the media and the rise of platforms like Twitter and Facebook to encourage an alternative reality experience for his supporters. The next Republican candidate to lose a close election may find some voters expecting him or her to mimic Donald Trump's conduct, and if a Democrat were to adopt the same tactics, the GOP would have no standing to complain. Still more important, legal and political experts said, is the way Donald Trump identified perilous pressure points within the system. Those vulnerabilities, they said, could be manipulated to destabilizing effect by someone else in a closer election, perhaps one that featured real evidence of tampering or foreign interference, or an outcome that delivers a winner who was beaten handily in the popular vote but scored a razor-thin margin of victory in the Electoral College. In those scenarios, it might not be such a long-shot gambit for a losing candidate to attempt to halt certification of election results through low-profile state and county boards, or to bestir state legislators to appoint a slate of electors, or to pressure political appointees in the federal government to block a presidential transition. Indeed, Donald Trump managed to intrude on normal election procedures in several states. He summoned Michigan Republican leaders to the Oval Office, as his allies floated the idea of appointing pro-Trump electors from the state, which Joe Biden carried by more than 150,000 votes. And he inspired an onslaught from the right against Georgia's Republican Secretary of State, Brad Raffensperger, who declined to affirm Donald Trump's false claims of ballot tampering. Though Mr. Raffensperger oversaw a fair election, both of Georgia's Republican senators, channeling the president, called for his resignation. Michael Lee, senior counsel at the Brennan Center for Justice, said the country had experienced a Lord of Flies moment that revealed just how willing some power actors were to enable an undisguised effort to sabotage a free and fair election. It's easy to laugh at the Trump challengers just because they've been so out there, Mr. Lee said. But what's scary is you step back from that a bit and see how many people were willing to go along with it until fairly deep in the process. There will be closer elections ultimately, he added. This one wasn't very close. The fact that people are willing to go down dangerous paths should give us all pause. It remains to be seen whether Donald Trump will wind up as a singularly sore loser or as the herald of a new Wild West era in American electioneering. There have been far closer elections in this century, including the 2000 vote that plunged the country into a week-long review of Florida's rickety vote counting procedures, and the 2016 election that made Donald Trump president, though a historically wide split between the popular vote and the Electoral College. But no one else has entertained the corrosive tactics Donald Trump has sought to employ. Like numerous other presidential schemes over the past 4 years, Mr. Trump's plot against the election unraveled in part because of external circumstances, the large number of swing states Joe Biden carried, for instance, and in part because of his own clumsiness. His lawyers and political advisors never devised an actual strategy for reversing the popular vote in multiple big states, relying on a combination of televised chest-thumping and wild claims of big city election fraud for which there was no evidence. Barbara Pariente, the former Chief Justice of the Florida Supreme Court who oversaw the state-level battle over the 2000 vote, said it was essential for Congress to clarify the process by which elections are conducted and resolved for risk greater calamity in the coming years. Donald Trump's team, she said, had already breached fundamental standards of legal conduct by filing cases seeking to throw out huge numbers of voters without any evidence of impropriety, and then asking a court to look further into it. As I look at what is happening now, I think it's a real attack on our American system of democracy, and it is causing tens of millions of Americans to doubt the outcome, Ms. Pariente said. It has grave implications, in my view, for the future of this country. Even if Congress were to impose a clearer set of election procedures, however, there is reason to doubt whether the rules could reverse the total war mindset that Donald Trump has modeled. In failure, he has created a roadmap for his own party, or even, under certain circumstances, for a grievance-laden Democrat to wage a bitter-end fight against an unfavorable election result, with the support of loud voices in the right-wing media and much of his party's conservative base. And it is that last cohort, the millions of voters who remain loyal to Donald Trump and who appear largely indifferent to the fact of the vote tally and the niceties of legal procedure, that represents the most potent kind of weapon for this defeated president or another executive who might follow his example. Sean Rosenberg, a professor of political and psychological science at the University of California at Irvine, who has written pessimistically about the trajectory of American democracy, said Donald Trump has been highly effective at exploiting the gap between the complexity of the country's political system and the more rudimentary grasp most voters have of their government. For the average partisan, he said, issues of political norms and procedures were very abstract and far less important than simply winning, an impulse Mr. Trump stoked to the detriment of democratic institutions. Rosenberg warned that while Donald Trump's political opposition had managed to unseat an incumbent, a rare feat in the nation's presidential system, the election was not the kind of overwhelming rout that might have proven American democracy invulnerable to the kind of erosion on display in newer democracies like Poland and India. That was something of a disappointment for Mr. Trump's critics on both the left and the right, he said. Their hope was that he had gone so far that he would awaken his awareness and resolve in the American people, Mr. Rosenberg said, and clearly that was not the case for roughly 74 million Americans.
food for thought.
Hello, dear listeners, and condolences to you all on a doleful day. Today is the 10th of Rabi Osani, and is the passing away anniversary of one of the noblest ladies of the Prophet's blessed household. She was Hazrat Fatima Ma'sumah, peace be upon her, the daughter of Imam Musa Kazem, peace be upon him, who, after a brief 17-day sojourn in the Iranian city of Qom, failed to recover from the fatigue of the long journey from Medina and departed for the ethereal heavens. On hearing this sad news, her brother, Imam Ali ibn Musa al-Riza, peace be upon him, who was in Khorasan, gave the tidings. Whoever visits her tomb, cognizant of her status, paradise is the reward.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
This is A to Z. An introduction to Islamic lifestyle. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of Allah, the Most Beneficent, the Most Merciful. Dear brothers and sisters, Assalamu alaikum. Peace and blessings of Allah be upon you all. This is A to Z, coming to you from IRIB English Radio, and I'm your host, Ali. This radio show is about Islamic lifestyle, and in each episode, we will be talking about a different lesson. Please stay with us till the end of today's program. Today's lesson, self-examination. Brothers and sisters, we all know that a human being is a composition of a body and soul. We have a physical body, we have a physical existence, and then we have a soul, which is our spiritual existence, or you can call it our metaphysical existence. Now, when it comes to self-examination yourself, you of course want to examine your physical existence and watch out for your physical well-being, but more importantly, you need to keep a very close eye on your spiritual existence. The spiritual existence is what requires a continuous and a robust examination because it's a very fine line to be spiritually healthy. Now, some of the questions, you know, we want to give to you as a starter, you know, something that would get you going. You would start thinking about self-examination and how to perform it. Ask yourself, for instance, am I spiritually awake and catering to the needs of my soul? Just our physical existence, our soul has also needs. Are we fulfilling those needs? The second question you can ask yourself is, today, the very day I'm living in, right now, have I gotten nearer to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, for instance, in times of prayers, or have I given in to laziness? Have I been lazy in performing my responsibilities and hence getting away and farther from Allah? This is a question you can ask yourself anytime while driving, while reading, you know, while going to bed, while brushing your teeth. Well, another question, again, to help you out is, today, has my faith been weakened by negligence or strengthened due to vigilance? Last but not the least, have I felt the presence of God, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, while making decisions in today? So these are some starters that will give you a thought process that will enable and help you to examine yourself. Welcome back to your listeners. We've been talking about self-examination, and that is not a physical exam that we're talking about. Of course, that's important in its own place, but today we're discussing the spiritual examination of oneself. We have brought to you a few questions before the break, which will enable and help you to examine yourself in an effective and a productive manner. Let's go over a few more thoughts before we conclude this episode. Another question is, have I made a productive use of my time, or have I been wasting my time on unnecessary activities? Another question, have I been extravagant and excessive in spending, or have I used my time, money, energies, and resources wisely? When we say wisely, it means really based on the instructions of Quran, Prophet, and Ahlul Bayt. And the last question for today's program is, have I governed my tongue, eyes, and other body parts today? So if you're vigilant, if you're asking these right questions to yourself, rest assured it's going to help you grow spiritually and maintain your spiritual health in the way it is supposed to be taken care of. Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, thank you very much for staying with us till the end of today's episode of A to Z. Don't forget to log on to our website at www.parstoday.com, Call of Islam page. We leave you all in the care of Allah. Till next time, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Yemen goes through hell every day. Poverty has been exacerbated by drought, famine, disease, embargo, and war. The Saudi-led campaign has opened a Pandora's box for the Yemeni people, including children. There are numerous reports that Yemeni kids as young as 7 are being recruited by the Saudi-led campaign to kill or be killed while fighting against their will and against their homeland. A little child in red identifies himself on a hill, facing his enemy on the other hill. Blood, bombs, bullets, and bodies. These are drawings by former child soldiers recruited by the Saudi-led coalition, which show what's going on inside their minds. It clearly shows they have been robbed of their childhoods, but they're not alone. In 2019, UNICEF reported that there are more than 2,700 cases of children enlisted in combat in Yemen, pointing out that this could be the tip of the iceberg. Exclusive footage from Al Jazeera shows that these children are being recruited to ironically defend the Saudi border, as if billions of dollars worth of purchased arms and military equipment are not enough for that purpose. One of these child soldiers is Ahmad Al-Naghi, from a village near Taiz, who left home when he was 15 years old. He'd been promised to get regular paychecks and a job in the kitchens of Yemeni military units on Saudi soil. We went because we were told we would be working in a kitchen and making 3,000 Saudi riyals, $800. So we believed them and got on the bus.
They know about the people that they are recruiting, people they are promising what seems to be large amounts of money, not delivering those large amounts of money, sometimes tricking them into being, thinking they're going to be workers, kitchen hands, or in some cases, and then being pushed into the front line with weapons. So I'm sure that they know about it, and I think it does reflect the fact that the Saudis have very little respect for people in their own system at the bottom of the heap, so to speak.
Investigative groups have identified a military camp in Al Bura, near the Saudi border, where the child recruits are being trained. The recruitment process is facilitated by human traffickers, and the recruits are given identification cards before crossing into Saudi Arabia and being placed into a military camp.
It's considered a war crime generally, because children, that is to say those under 18, are not considered capable of giving an informed consent to take on the responsibility of joining a military and being under orders to carry out what might be serious criminal activity. Remember that soldiers since the Second World War are regarded to have their own capacity to reject orders which require them to carry out crime. So there is a type of adult conscience and a capacity to, on the one hand, take on responsibility, on the other hand, to disobey orders, which are criminal orders. And so children are not capable of that. They're taken advantage of. And the trickery I mentioned before is something that also children are very susceptible to. So there's less chance of children rejecting those sorts of orders or standing up against resisting what they're being asked to do. So that's why there's this general consensus around the world that children should not be recruited into, particularly going into situations where they are engaged in conflicts that they don't understand.
According to Geneva-based human rights monitoring organization, SAM, Many Yemenis are entering the kingdom under the pretext of receiving emergency treatment, only to be sent to the Yemeni-Saudi border to fight for Riyadh. The Saudi-led coalition is recruiting boys from schools, poor urban areas, and detention centers, inducing them to fight with a combination of bribes, indoctrination, and coercion, according to the Times.
I think it's really taking advantage of poor families, both Yemeni families in the border areas, and also poor families in the surrounding regions, including from Sudan, taking advantage of recruiting these young people, promising them, tricking them in some cases into sending their young people in to act as very ineffective soldiers in this terrible war. And it's also reflects, I think, a part of the Saudi culture of disrespect for these young people. They don't really care if they live or die.
But the Saudi-led coalition does not recruit only Yemeni children. In late 2018, Riyadh came under fire for recruiting Sudanese children to fight on its behalf in Yemen. Tens of thousands of desperate survivors of the conflict in Darfur, many of them children, are now fighting in Yemen. Most of them belong to the paramilitary Rapid Support Forces, a tribal militia previously known as the Janjaweed. These children are reportedly being paid in Saudi riyals, the equivalent of about $480 a month for a 14-year-old novice. They receive an additional $185 to $285 for any month they saw combat. Their payments were deposited directly into the Faisal Islamic Bank of Sudan, partly owned by Saudis. According to the Times, Sudanese soldiers who fought in Yemen said that between 20% and 40% of their units were made up of children.
I think we need to understand what the Saudis represent in the region. That's very important, that the Saudis are there as an arm of the old colonial regime, of the British regime initially and now run by the North Americans, that they are a proxy for effectively a barrier between the British and the Americans being held accountable for their responsibilities for the terrible dirty war and the humanitarian catastrophe in Yemen, that really these young people that are being recruited by the Saudis are effectively masking the responsibility of the NATO powers that are sending so many arms and weapons to perpetuate this sort of war. And I don't think we can understand that unless we understand the role of the Saudis and the fact that they are only there to carry out the orders of these big powers from outside trying to manipulate events within the region. So I think that the role of Al-Saud, generally the family, needs to be understood to understand why there are so many appalling acts going on, including the use of child soldiers to perpetuate this dirty war against Yemen.
A dirty game has been at play since the Saudi-led invasion of Yemen. With billions of dollars in their pockets, the Saudi-led gang is still trying to outsource the war. They want to keep the cost of the war at the lowest possible level. So they're using child mercenaries from poor backgrounds in Yemen or Sudan. Those whose lives are cheaper than the ones in Saudi Arabia, the UAE, and Bahrain.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily, round the clock, for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, medium wave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 41 meters, 7,300 kilohertz every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 49 meters, 6,040 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5 and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
In the limelight.
According to AirWars, a UK-based non-profit organization that works to track and assess military actions in conflict zones, the new data has allowed for the accurate locating of just 341 incidents of civilian harm and roughly 1,400 civilian deaths from 2014 to 2019 that have been acknowledged by the U.S. military. Air Wars estimates that the total number of civilians killed by U.S.-led coalition forces during the war is somewhere in the range of 8,310 to 13,187. It's more than that. A new mechanism should also be set up to receive and assess any future war crimes these forces may commit in Afghanistan, Iraq, and Syria. It's only a way to prevent similar future incidents and ensure justice for the victims. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by the staff of Fars News Agency, which is published under the heading, Time to Charge U.S. and Allies with War Crimes. Stay tuned for the details of this article, please. The U.S. military has for the first time published the geographic coordinates for nearly all confirmed instances of civilian harm and deaths in Iraq and Syria, although true numbers are way beyond those confirmed by the Pentagon. According to Air Wars, a UK-based non-profit organization that works to track and assess military actions in conflict zones, the new data has allowed for the accurate locating of just 341 incidents of civilian harm.